afternoon. Now I waited like 2 seconds. It seemed weird, huh?
Yeah.
Good afternoon. And welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. It is March 2nd. Welcome to St. Patty's Day run-up. My favorite time of year.
March is a great month.
It is a great month.
Yeah.
I have a nice nice green flag out front to make St. Patrick's Day great again. This is special for my neighbor.
You should get one that says, make my birthday great again.
Oh,
yeah.
That's right, because Bill's birthday is the end of March.
Yeah.
The very end.
Yep.
We'll do something for that.
24. Again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice. Yep, you've got birthdays made for radio.
That's right.
As they say. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Now that we know that, and his birthday's on March 30th. Robert, who does our archives, his birthday was yesterday. Robert, do you want to claim you were 24?
No, I was 57.
Oh, 57. He's going
57
for
57 again.
He's going for 57. Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm 63, and that's real, so there you go. I don't care. It's not worth lying about. What the heck? So, hey, for all those of you who just in random information who thought that, you know, things like when President Trump says he's going to be a king, if you're, say, calling your congressman's office or your local officials demanding to have that corrected because he thinks he's a king, that's called joking. That is joking. And the way you know that it's joking is because it's funny. And that's a dead giveaway. And if this is if this is informational for you, I have a cure. It doesn't involve any kind of, you know, group or, you know, you don't have to drive anywhere really.
You don't have to join a club.
No, you can just like go on Amazon.
Three-step program.
Yeah, go on Amazon or maybe find like somebody that you find annoying because they're probably funny. And they probably have all of Gary Larson's Far Side cartoon books. Just go get one. And if like half of them don't make sense to you, then you're going to need the professional help.
Yeah.
But other than that, there's going to be some joking.
And we have some recommendations there, too, who you can go buy. It's going to cost more than a Far Side book.
I mean, really. How do we know it's joking? Well, I don't know. It's funny. I know how to do it. So, moving directly into our more serious topic. Honestly, for all those of you who have listened to the show for the last 15 years, you'd be like, oh, my God, they're talking about wolves again? Yes, we are. Because all of the stuff we told you, like 12 or 13 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, how long ago was it since really we talked about wolves?
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
I went back and researched the shows. I was like, true,
yeah.
That was a while
ago. We gave them time to mature and breed and multiply.
Well, we kind of said that all these things would happen and... Well, shazam, you know, they're happening. So we are going to chat today with Mike Costello. He is with an organization called HOWL, H-O-W-L, in case I don't enunciate properly, HOWL for Wildlife. They educate the public, both non-hunting and hunting, public, not the howling thing, about cultural, economic, ecological, conservation, and sustenance sides of hunting. We then give people tools to take action on hunting, fishing, and conservation issues. So they have a really, really wide range of information and ideas, and it isn't all just like, you know, how to buy a nice pocket knife. It isn't that kind of stuff. It's very interesting. They do a lot of things with... the legislature and how to empower people. And I was at a meeting with him the other day, and he gave people some really excellent advice. I'm going to make him do it again. But our new best friend, Mike Costello, is a lifelong Californian with an affinity for big open spaces that make the Golden State special. He's drawn to the high alpine basins, scrubby sage-covered deserts, and the salt, surf, and sand of the coast. What about the redwoods? We left them out. Okay, I'll take care of the redwoods. He believes that our connection to nature goes beyond the need to observe and preserve. He sees human participation essential to ecology. Stewardship, harvesting, balancing, and protecting healthy ecosystems are rights and responsibilities that we must hold on to. At HOWL for Wildlife, Mike contributes to communications strategy. They believe that hunting is human and that modern regulated hunting is the most economically and ecologically sustainable tool for conservation. And I have to say, I agree with 100% of that.
Yeah.
And I know Bill does too.
Yeah.
There you go. So, Mike, I don't know where you want to start today, because this is a deep, deep topic.
You nailed that intro. Thank you.
Yeah, well, you and I are only two of, what, six or seven? Although I shouldn't post all their pictures, but I did take pictures from the our vantage point the other night up in Alturas. And yeah. The stark difference between an angry mob listening to bureaucrats tell them word salad stuff about wolves and you explaining how it really works was stunning, actually.
Yeah.
I got a little bit of applause, which was really surprising, and I was thankful for it, because everybody that went before me, it was some stone cold silence.
Oh, yeah. That was like
conversation.
Well, and you know, full disclosure, you know, I kind of leaned over at one point and said, "It's a good thing there's no rope in this room." Like, it was ugly.
Yeah.
It was ugly, and people are sick of it, because, you know, I mean, wolves, for anybody out there who still doesn't know this, wolves kill to eat, they kill to teach their young, and they kill for sport. And sport doesn't mean the animal dies. It means they chase them around, bite them, or whatever,
right.
Eat parts of them, and then leave them.
Yeah.
They are an apex predator for a reason. Like, that's why we call them that. And to think that
they're
just like fluffy big dogs, right?
They're beautiful. And I think that's one of the problems is they're beautiful animals, and they're closely related to the dogs that we have at home. And so it's of course there's going to be an affinity to liking them charismatically, emotionally, but from the practical aspects of wolves just get left out of the conversation too often. And it becomes a discussion of the extremes. And you know, that's just never healthy.
No.
It's never healthy for actually creating solutions.
Well, then there's kind of that, avoidance of history, which we see a lot in huge amounts of environmental policy, is an avoidance of history. And I'll post the article because I found it again the other day. It's really easy to look up. But in 1911, a wedding party of, I think it was like 125 people, was attacked and killed by a pack of wolves in Russia. Now, I mean, so when people say, well, they never attack people, like, well, over 100 years ago they did. When there were lots of them. So wolves are not that... You just don't want them in your...
No.
You know, you don't want them
If they decide they want to come after you, they're going to come after you, and good luck.
Yeah. I'll also post the pictures of the kids in the cages that we used to talk about over 10 years ago down in New Mexico, because the kids were viewed as little snacks. And so people didn't want to leave their snacks standing on the side of the road waiting for the school bus because the wolves were waiting for them. Which happens when you get enough of them. So you want to tell us about your organization, or you want to talk about wolves and hope we have time for your organization, I think, is the communications director.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about the organization
yeah,
first.
Good call.
And then we'll move into the other issues. Howell, and you read through the intro perfectly there, and you extracted from our website, you know, really a really good summary of what we do. We focus on advocacy, we enable advocacy, we focus on strategic communication that gets to decision makers when a decision is being made. And typically that would be like a regulation change regarding hunting or legislation regarding hunting or wildlife management. And I think the first thing that we noticed a few years ago was that hunters as a community, they like to be in the woods, disconnected from all the stuff that happens, you know, down at the Capitol. Like, that's what's going on at the Capitol is usually the antithesis of what a lot of people that hunt want to deal with. And so we've been removed from a lot of that organizationally and as a community. And so, but we also have seen over the years rights, privileges, opportunities, you know, things that have to do with wildlife and hunting opportunity, those things have been degraded kind of systematically. Every state's had a little bit of degradation. California's had a lot.
And well, they changed the name. I mean, it used to be the Department of Fish and Game.
Fish and Game.
Which went so well with the Department of Fun and Games, but anyway, we enjoyed that a lot, and now they've turned it into wildlife.
Yeah, Fish and Wildlife, and for some reason, CDFW has to deal with cannabis, too. It's not under agriculture. I don't get that. But we've seen these things degraded, and so there's a sense or a sentiment that we as a community are always going to lose. We're always going to lose if there's a threat to hunting. And this came up with black bear hunting in California. And, you know, we saw about 30,000 tags for black bear hunting in California. We maybe harvest only about 1,000 bears a year right now. But there's 30,000 human beings that buy a tag to go out into the woods and hunt bears in California. And so this attack came through primarily through the Humane Society of the U.S., HSUS, to ban black bear hunting. And it was kind of a tipping point for us as a community, for hunters. And I'm talking about from waterfowl to deer to rabbit hunters to squirrel hunters to bear hunters. Like the whole hunting community realized this is going too far. This attack on a sustainable harvest of an abundant critter that provides good protein, good resources for people to take off the landscape was too much, and the community of hunters across numerous species and really across state lines even came together and said, heck no. Like, we're going to tell you who we are and why this is valuable to us, why this is important to us at a personal level. And we were able to convey to the commission stories about hunting and values of hunters that they were not hearing. They were just seeing the very, you know, antagonistic and divisive rhetoric from the HSUS about who these people are that go out and slaughter these animals. And we weren't presenting that value statement. We weren't those people that they thought we were. And the commission realized, you know, we're going to support this unanimously. We're going to tell the department, yeah, go back and revise and update your management plan, get your science better. But this hunt is important for a lot of reasons that we weren't even aware of. And the reason the commission wasn't aware of it, because we weren't telling our stories. We weren't taking the time to share our values and the reasoning behind them into that venue or even into the public space. And so we left the arena unattended to where, because we didn't like the rules. We didn't like the rules. We didn't like the rest. So we left the arena unattended. And that meant that the anti-hunting industry could define these stories for us. And they never do it favorably. You know, the anti-hunting animal rights extremists, animal protectionist extremists, they never tell the story of the hunter in a favorable light. And so we kind of left that void to be filled by somebody that was never going to represent us. And that's what HAL is all about, is developing the value statements that who we are, why we do what we do, the fact that we love critters. Like, nobody goes out and hunts an animal because they're angry at it. We don't hunt.
I never really thought about that, but I bet they do think that.
Yeah, even wolf hunters that hunt wolves in Idaho, they're pursuing adventure. It is physically and mentally and emotionally, psychologically demanding. It's one of the most demanding hunts in the world to hunt wolves. They're not angry at those animals. Those animals are being wolves. You know, they're doing what wolves do, and they're going out and pursuing that animal. There is a conservation ethic to what they're doing because they know that they're helping balance an ecosystem. But they're not angry at the wolves. And so we're not angry at these animals, any of them. So we've got to capture those statements and those reasons for why we participate. And the reasons are as diverse as
you also have to include like a little bit of logic, right? So, I mean, that's like saying that when ants take over your kitchen, you just suddenly develop a hatred for ants, which it's not a very good example. I guess there is that. But you're not killing the ants because you hate them. You just don't want them in your kitchen. Like, I don't care what they do outside. Go
get out of my space.
Go do ant stuff outside. But stay out of my cupboards and off the dog.
No, that's a great analogy. That's a perfect analogy.
I mean, it's silly because I don't care where you live. You deal with things that don't belong there. You know, we all kind of have our space. And the thing is, ants, although they're kind of destructive and kind of make you crazy, they're at least not going to kill you in your sleep. Well, I guess if you lived in a foreign country, maybe they have those kind. Robert's scoffing at me. He doesn't think so. I'm going to research and I'm going to find out.
Well, some kind of little six-legged insect that will.
See? Thanks, Mike. That's why I like you. That's why you're my new best friend. We have to take a really quick break. We're here with Mike Costello from Howl for Wildlife. Bill is absorbed in their webpage, and we've lost him. We've lost him to the internet, but we'll get him back.
A lot of good information.
Come back.
Oh, take a quick break. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at
wethepeopleradio.us.
He's back.
That I see walking in these woods. Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood.
Darn, we cut off the howl at the beginning. That's the best part. Yeah, that's the kicker of it. Robert, before he left, pointed out that they do use ants for torture. So, yeah, there is that. Ants are back in the blacklist. So, you guys are not. There are a lot of organizations that are like have great information, lots of camaraderie, terrific websites, all that. But they're basically kind of clubs. They're not action oriented, and they're not. Your website, I thought your organization. It seems like it's a kind of old expression, but you seek to load people's mouths. You know, give them the right stuff to talk about. And the right way to approach the problem. And I wanted you to tell the shoot, shovel, and shut up thing before we forget. I thought that was important when you shared that with people the other night. And initially I thought, oh, they're going to attack you too. But they didn't. It made sense.
Right. Well, folks thought I was from a pro-wolf advocacy group because the name of the organization.
Right.
And so we get that sometimes. And I think it's fair to say that it was a strategic decision of our own to have a name that's a little bit ambiguous as to, like, you know, where we stand in the space. Because we actually do believe that all critters have a space on the planet. Like, we should have room for all wildlife. But there's also a management requirement in doing that. And humans are part of that, too. Humans have to have space. So you called out, you mentioned the shoot, shovel, shut up thing. Because a lot of hunters, I believe, have a great sense of disenfranchisement. They feel powerless in a lot of these issues, especially dealing with wolves and grizzly bears as they're being, you know, allowed to recolonize North America. Oftentimes with no support for the local stakeholders that are actually affected by those animals, there's an equally negative response to that disenfranchisement, and it's often just, you know, shoot, shovel, shut up. We're gonna kill these animals no matter what. You know, I see that animal, I'm gonna kill it. And I think 98% of that's bravado, just kind of false internet warrior, keyboard warrior bravado. And it's a way of saying in three words or three letters, I'm angry about this. I have no voice. You don't give me an opportunity to participate in the process. And so this is how I'm going to react. But when we say that, we literally are making the very inflammatory rhetoric for the other side of the deal, the pro wolf at any cost. We're making their propaganda for them. Like, we're literally packaging up, you know,
yeah.
our frustration and giving it to the other side so they can use it against us. Because ultimately, I really don't think most people truly feel that way. I don't think if people are actually doing that, they're talking about it. And I think the most people, you know, let's say the 10% or the 80% of the folks in the middle that live in the suburbs, they've got a mortgage and two jobs, three kids, a dog, and a softball team to coach. They're just busy. Like, they're just busy, and they want to know that the critters are doing okay.
Yeah.
And so when we say that, we fall into a trap of, you know, those people that just want to know that the critters are going to be okay, they will immediately turn against us because there's no context, they don't understand the frustration, and they've got this other argument that's being presented by the wolves at any cost advocacy groups of a beautiful animal with a slogan that says, those people just want to kill all the wolves. And then we say that, and
mic check.
We make their case.
Yeah. See, yeah. That's the kicker. Because it does make their case. And I sat through all those stakeholder meetings prior to the listing, and that is what they said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so we have to think strategically. Like, we have to think and talk strategically, because what I think we don't realize is that those advocacy groups don't represent 80% of the people. They're a very small group of people that are ideological.
There is something bizarre going on with our...
Something going on. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you fine, but...
Can you hear me now?
Your coverage is excellent, but we've been infiltrated by some sort of electronic thing.
Yeah. Those advocacy groups are ideologically driven, and they're a small group of stakeholders. They're a very small group of people, but they're loud.
Yeah,
and they think and speak strategically, so we have to do the same. We need to think about, like, what's the average voter who ultimately, you know, does have a say in this, whether we like them to or not. They do have a say in what electeds and commissions and, you know, what those folks are going to do. So we need to think about what's the right argument that makes progress on behalf of what we're trying to achieve, and that's for humans to have space. That's for ranchers to have space where they can feel protected and they can have their livestock and they can steward their animals. It's so that the wildlife, the other wildlife on the landscape can have space. The mule deer, the elk, the antelope, you know, et cetera. We can't, it's not healthy. I don't think it's healthy to introduce. You got to acknowledge that when wolves and grizzly bears are recolonizing an area, it is disruptive to not just the people, but also the other wildlife. And I think we as humans have a responsibility to moderate that disruption, protect the humans settled areas, and also protect some of the wildlife that are also naive. They haven't seen wolves or grizzly bears in hundreds of years or 100 years.
True.
So we can steward them successfully too by not forcing, like in Colorado, the reintroduction is basically a forced acceleration of putting wolves into places that they haven't showed up naturally on their own.
Well, that was California.
Yeah.
I mean, California, they were not here. They weren't.
There's a debate there. Let's talk. I think that's a good debate, you know, whether or not they walked in or not.
Well, I mean, there was a lady sitting in the front row of that meeting that we attended last week that has video of the helicopter and the four-wheeler, because it was on their property, you know.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, where they pushed OR-7 across the border.
Okay.
But multiple times over a period of, I'm guessing at this point, but it was long, like I'm going to say 8 months, maybe. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen just one time. It wasn't like someone chased him, he ran across the border and went, oh, my God, California is so yummy, I'm going to stay. Like, it didn't really work that way. But yeah, all during those stakeholder meetings where they were, you know, coming up with their plan or whatever, just in case, there were these repeated sightings of the people who live up there. And it was on the 97 corridor. It wasn't everywhere. It was really really on the backside of Klamath Falls and like Siskiyou and Modoc counties where they come together there.
Wow.
So anyway, I mean, so people really felt like they were getting played.
Sure. And because the goalposts are set so far apart, like there's no management in, you know, there's a management plan, but effectively when you have, you know, it's a $100,000 fine, like 10 years in prison if you shoot a wolf because it's on the federal list, with almost no context available for you to do anything to defend your property, defend your livestock, the animal has to be attacking you directly. And so the goalposts are set so far apart that, people are just frustrated and they want, and we're gonna naturally latch on to extremes of the discussion. And we often lose sight of whose mind do we have to change? Like yeah. We have to, and right now, you know, this is, delisting is going to be considered in the at the federal level in the legislature, and whose mind we have to change is 60 senators.
Yeah.
Well, maybe 10.
Yeah, I was going to say, we probably only need like, yeah, I mean, we should shoot long, but, you know, maybe 6, 7, 8,
yeah.
Something like that. And the bad part is that some of them that could have come along with us, like maybe Tester up in Montana, we already flipped those seats. Oops.
Right. Right.
But
we locked that vote up, but it wasn't.
Yeah, too bad. It's and you know, you look at Schiff and Padilla in California. They should care about their constituents in California, but I'm pretty sure that there's not a lot of.
There's no.
It's not affecting.
Yeah, it's not affecting 95%
of the state.
Yeah. Do they feel that the introduction into Yellowstone was a success?
Well, it depends on what the goals are. I think most people would say that the introduction, if the goal was to reestablish wolves in the Northern Rockies, I think that you would say, yeah, it was successful. Wolves are there. There's been, you know, there's this theory of a trophic cascade where the entire ecosystem, you know, changes and evolves.
The guy with the accent. I'm totally posting that video.
Yeah.
That guy makes me want to harm someone. Yeah.
Yeah, they leave out other environmental factors. They leave out that beavers were also introduced at the same time, and beavers are probably did more of the engineering of the creeks and streams and rivers in Yellowstone than wolves did. I mean, it crushed the elk population by 75%.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at. Is the elk were heavily populated in that area, and they've been pretty much decimated, haven't they?
Yeah. I mean, they're 25%. I think they're about 25% of historically before wolves were introduced. And there are people that would say, well, that's nature. That's the natural status of things, and that's okay. But you know, the Earth. I like to say the Earth is not a snow globe. Like, we can't remove ourselves from it and just stand back and not be part of it. Humans have been harvesting protein from the landscape since the beginning of time, and we've been competing for resources, competing with wolves for resources in space. Since the beginning of time. And so you have to make a really big values statement to say that it's right to have wolves dominate the landscape and reduce the elk by 75%, because the only way that's really a great thing is if you're saying that humans shouldn't have the opportunity to also harvest from the landscape. Why don't we? You know, I think we do. I think wolves could be there. Like, wolves were always there. That's fine. But we also competed with them, and now we compete with them still. And so, but we're being forced into this box, especially in Northern California and Eastern Oregon and wherever wolves are, you know, newly recolonizing. We're forced into a box where basically the humans just have to stand by and watch, even as wolves are severely affecting wildlife populations and severely affecting domestic livestock populations. And that's where people feel powerless, and that's when they feel the most likely to say the thing that turns off the folks in the suburbs from supporting us.
Yeah.
It's a very hard space to be in.
Well, the thing is, how long, and we heard people ask this, I mean, they're losing animals.
Right. And
you know, for anybody who maybe doesn't live in a rural area listening in maybe some other state, I don't care where you live, your meat comes from somewhere. It's raised
probably by a rural area.
Yeah, it's made raised by a rancher somewhere.
Right.
And that's the, I mean, that's where these cattle live is amazing country. These are not feedlots. These are in incredible spaces with open grazing areas. But then you allow the wolves to overpopulate, and there's no check on that.
Yeah.
Wolf takes cattle every time.
Yep. And right now it seems like it's multiple times a week right now.
Oh yeah. I mean it's rock versus paper. Paper never really, you know. I mean, it's bad. One of the ladies who was there the other night said she was driving. They have like 40,000 acres, and she was driving into town or somewhere, and she said she spotted 9 different animals. Just in various stages of either dead or dying.
Wow.
So
that's brutal.
Yeah, it is.
These
brutal.
Folks are stewards. You know, the. I mean, yes. If you have livestock, you have dead stock. You know, life and death are humans are so removed from life and death. Like it's crazy. And so, if you're a rancher and you got 1,000 animals, you are going to have some that die. But it hurts. Like it's not just like. You know, it's not just a transaction where you say, oh, the wind shifted and we had an animal die. Like, the ranchers care. And so, you know, yeah, ranching is hard and livestock, there are deaths in the herd, but you do everything you can to prevent them and protect animals. And then when you have, especially the most, vulnerable of them being calves or new, you know, cows that are giving birth to a calf. When you have those animals being the ones that are so quickly and easily attacked by wolves, they weren't sick, you know?
Right.
They weren't sick.
Oh, my
they
God.
Weren't hurt.
You heard that?
It was just, yeah. You know, they're most vulnerable, maybe at their healthiest, you know, but most vulnerable moment in life, and they're attacked. And then, like you said, a lot of these wolves, they will kill more than they need for their own consumption.
Oh, yeah, they're not eating them all. And I do, oh, that brings back bad memories. I do remember back in those idiotic stakeholder meetings where they were crafting their wolf plan. Oh, but by the way, there was never any paper and no one ever wrote anything down, so I'm not really sure how much input was really being given. But they used to say, oh, no, the wolves only eat the weak. They cull the herd. They only eat the weak animals and the sick ones and the dying. And I'm like, you know, if you think about that from a human perspective, that's like going to the grocery store and picking up all the bad produce. Like,
right.
I want the potatoes with all the black spots and the brown lettuce. Like, because I'm gonna make the vegetable and fruit section better. Like, what?
Yeah.
No one does that.
I think Disney had that woven into some of their movies. And it sounds great. And there's probably a little bit of truth to it, but it's not what they do.
Like, well, they might snag the slow
runner.
They're
going to go after whatever they can.
Yeah. The guy who runs too slow might grab him, you know, like the old joke, you know, how do you outrun a bear?
Yeah.
You know, run faster than your friend. But, yeah, that's just silly. We have to, on that note, we have to take a really quick break again. This is going to go really fast, darn it. I better shut up.
Yeah, I want to talk about wild wolves.
Okay. I get all jacked up about this. I'll put my muzzle on. Probably unlikely. Okay, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Our guest is Mike Costello with Howl for Wildlife, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
every day now, never meaning what they say now, never saying what they mean. While they while away the hours in their ivory towers, till they're covered up with flowers in the back of a black limousine. Whoa, la da da.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the games people play, Mike.
Yeah, the wild wolves.
Yeah. So if there's probably a few people listening, maybe one or two that view themselves as wolf advocates and wolf lovers, and that's fair. And I think it's fair to say that it'd be great if we could have wolves in our wild places and wild ecosystems, even thriving. And I think that visual would be, you know, wolves living in wilderness areas that you don't have a lot of human traffic, you don't have livestock, and they're living amongst abundant herds of elk and deer and antelope and porcupines and skunks and possums and all these other critters that they might feed on. And that to me is a charismatic and attractive vision. I think that sounds great. A problem that we have right now is to get to that point in California is that we don't have abundant, thriving herds of elk and deer and antelope for those wolves to thrive on. And then, you know, the wolf advocates might say, well, the wolves will only succeed if those herds are there. So it's just about the ecosystem that can support them. That might be true, but the problem is that what we're seeing is that wolves in California and a lot of other places where they recolonize close to humans is they're heavily subsidized by livestock and other sources of food from humans, goats, you know, I guess those would be livestock, small ruminants, goats, sheep, cattle, horses, etc. So we're not developing, and because of that, I don't think we're developing a good base of wolves that are even wild. You know, the wolves that have been spending a lot of time in northern California right now, they have no care if humans are within stone's throw of them. Like, they'll stand there and stare at you from 50 yards and just look at you like, I don't care that you're there.
Are these wolves that are all collared?
No, not all collared.
Okay.
Some of the wolves that are up in Modoc aren't collared. Most of them aren't collared, actually. And I know one of the ranchers was telling me, like, the wolves were just across the fence, like 50, 100 feet away.
Right.
And the wolf had no concern about this human who should be the only animal that the wolf is concerned about. The human should be the only animal, other than maybe a grizzly bear, that wolves care about and are concerned about. But they're not concerned about humans. They're getting a high percentage of their food source from humans, so they're subsidized. And so that when we do have a bad winter and the other prey species, you know, they have a big die-off because there's a terrible winter or a terrible drought, well, the wolves are subsidized by human food, livestock, so they don't feel that pinch from nature. So we're effectively developing this we're, you know, because they're protected so completely, there's no friction against them interacting in human-settled areas, taking human-provided food. They're not fearful of humans. They're not really developing as a wild species living their best life on the wild landscape right now. And I don't know at what point you can reverse that, because these wolves, they learn from the family, the pack that they're in. They learn from their parents. They learn from their other pack mates. And if every generation of these wolves is getting, you know, 20 to 30% of their protein, their food from livestock, at what point do we say, oh, we need to reverse that trend?
Well, and they also have interaction with humans at the same time.
And there's no friction. Those interactions are not negative.
Right.
To a wolf. And so how do you reverse that? Like, you know, if we go from 100 wolves now, or say there's 100 to 200 wolves now, 3-4 years from now there's 400 to 600 wolves, when do we just magically make the decision, oh, we're going to start introducing friction now and the wolves will learn? Like, that's a reality check that doesn't just happen overnight.
No.
Like, we don't have a magic wand to wave to fix that.
Well,
so when, I think we're developing like kids that don't get like the kids that don't give you know, aren't given guardrails in third grade. They, you know, they don't necessarily behave well in 12th grade.
Yeah, yeah, which is 100% true, 100% of the time.
Right.
The other piece of this that I mean, we should ultimately highlight for people are the diseases that wolves bring in. And so the closer they come into human population, could be maybe you just hike in the woods. Maybe you're not a hunter. You don't live in a rural area, but you take your family out. And if wolves have kind of overtaken that landscape, A, you're in danger. But B, you cross up with some of the diseases that they carry and take that home.
Yep.
That's potentially
well,
deadly.
Those diseases also cross over to other species.
Right.
You know, your deer right. and everything else will end up with the same issue.
Yeah.
You mentioned the human safety part in hiking. I spend a lot of time in the woods. I've only seen a mountain lion in person once. I know mountain lions have seen me probably more times than I want to know. But I've only seen a mountain lion one time, and it was a little bit hair-raising. I've seen a lot of bears. I sleep on the ground in the woods with no tent. Like I just, if a bear's to me, it's going to make a little bit of noise, snortling in my face, and then run away probably, because that's what black bears mostly do. But I was hiking when I came up to Modoc County for the meeting to go on a hike on like a 1,000-acre ranch by myself, and I was hiking. Thought, oh shucks. Oh, and I rarely carry a weapon.
Mic check.
Because I'm not worried about it. You know, I'm about the critters attacking me because most of them are scared of me. And the next morning as I'm doing this hike, I'm realizing, you know what, if I came across three wolves in this area right now, they wouldn't be afraid of me. And it gave me a little bit of like we're getting point in a lot of California from the Tahoe North. You could find a wolf any given day, any area, Tahoe to the Oregon border, that if you come with a wolf or three wolves in that area, they're not scared of you.
Right.
And they will attack your dog. They will attack your dog. You know, so it's like we're in a new space now because animals don't have any friction. They have no reason to be concerned about human engagement. And that's a problem.
Well, there's, you know, the one word. If I was in a coma and you wanted to wake me up, all you have to do is come in my hospital room and say Fladry. Mm-hmm. I would just jump out of that bed, probably pummel you. It just makes me absolutely go mental. It's the myth of their stupid Fladry, which, for people who don't have to attend annoying meetings about this kind of stuff, is stupid little pieces of rags, little colored pieces of rags that are going to tie them on the fences, and the Fladry will blow in the wind, and the wolves will run away in fear. I'm like, okay.
Right.
Okay. Much more likely they would dress up in clothing and hide in a house, in a bed, and wait for Little Red Riding Hood. Much more likely.
Yeah, I've never heard the Fladry part.
Oh, you never heard about Fladry?
No, I never have.
Said it the other night. I was like, God dang it. So what about all the places that don't have fences? What is the real thing on that these days? Like, they made it sound like, we will come out there and we will put up Fladry for you. What's that meaning these days?
How did this work?
Your signal is going cuckoo all of a sudden.
Fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Hang on.
Here we have the. Better. It's funny. The traffic board is busting in and telling us things like mic check. We don't know what that's about. She's out there trying to figure that out, and all of a sudden your signal's going away. I'm like. Conspiracy.
How am I now?
It's the Center for Biological Diversity. They've hacked the station. What?
Probably. Am I better now?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, years ago,
I lied. You're not better.
No, you're breaking up real bad.
Now it's going crazy.
Okay. Better now.
I don't know. Keep talking.
My goodness.
Are you on a? Are you on a? On a microphone?
A speaker. He's the communications coordinator for Hal. Come on. Guy's a professional.
Know.
He knows
know.
This stuff.
Well, no, I do 13 communications. I don't coordinate them. You good now? No?
It's weird. Something happened to your signal. You were really good at the beginning, but something's kind of gone a little bananas. Hey, so we're figuring that out. I don't know what's going on in Engineering Town. Oh, she said she sent me a message in Engineering Town.
I can hear you really well.
Okay. Well, I come from I come from a family with very loud voices, so you know everybody can always hear the Ryans. there has never been anyone who said, "Gosh, those Ryan kids! I didn't even know where they were."
How are we doing? How are you now?
Oh, that's much
better. That's really good.
Yeah. I'm standing out looking at a hailstorm that just came through. So that's good.
Oh, that might be it.
Yeah, I think the clouds came in and dampened the signal or something. So, but, you know, 500 years ago, how did this work? You know, I don't think that the human settled areas and the folks that lived on North America 500 years ago let wolves just walk through their settlement and take whatever they wanted to. So why were wolves scared of humans 500 years ago? It's because the humans would kill them if they got too close and they were competing for space and resources. And so that friction creates a very natural balance to, you know, the habitat. And we're being told, go install bright lights and disco balls and waving flags and all this. So I'm just imagining, like, somebody hiking out in the woods or enjoying the wilderness. They come up over the ridge and they look down at night, you know, at dusk, and it looks like there's a electronic dance concert going on in the valley, with all these noises and flags and lights to keep the wolves away.
Oh, terrific.
And is that really what we, yes, we have all this modern stuff, but is that really what's stewarding the land looks like?
Yeah. Is that giving the wolves really their best environment to live in? I don't think so.
Right. And it works once. I think it does work. I think there's a point where it works. Wolves see that like, oh, this wasn't here last time I came through. You know, they do their, you know, they got hundreds of square miles that they cover at their habitat, and they might have like a month, like a 30-day loop that they make as they cover their habitat. And so, they come up and they see this, and they're startled by it, and they kind of stay away, just like a new puppy stays away from something that it hasn't seen before. But then, you know, they come back to it again a month later, and it's still there, like, that's interesting. And then they're hungry and they see a critter of a lamb or a goat or a calf on the other side of it. And they're like, I'm going to take a shot at that. I'm not so worried about that flag light thing anymore.
Yeah,
I've seen it a few times. And then they get that positive reinforcement of getting food and now they don't care about that anymore. So I think there's been studies that show it works, but I don't think there's been studies that show it works for 5 years.
See, that's the kicker. It just is, I don't know.
It feels good for the moment, but it doesn't actually create a sustainable impact.
Yeah, they used to come up with that all the time, and even back then everybody was like, wait a second, little wavy rags on a fence. Besides that, if you're out in open range land, mm-hmm. it's not all fenced. That's why we call it open range, you know?
Right.
I mean, they're kind of assuming everybody's got 5 acres with a little animal in the background, and that's not real. So, we have to break for the news. And then we're going to come back with our guest, Mike Costello, who is with Howl for Wildlife. And you can find all the info about them and the archive of the show later today at wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And without further ado, or more silliness, we've had some technical mamma jamma today. That's a radio term.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's radio talk.
Yeah, mamma jamma. So our guest is Mike Costello. He is with Howl for Wildlife, and their little thing here kind of says it all. We educate the public, both non-hunting and hunting, about the cultural, economic, ecological, conservation, and sustenance sides of hunting. We then give people the tools to take action on hunting, fishing, and conservation issues. And I gotta say, it's an organization you should plug in with. They have a lot of information. Their website's great. I don't know who did that for you, Mike, but it's terrific. And you can click on, I swiped some of it and I put it on so the links were there in case somebody didn't want to make the jump. But the show is airing originally on March 2nd, 2025. So if we replay it later, you'll know what was going on at the time. But, you know, you've got links here. The ones I snagged for today's show out of your lineup, thoughts on predator reintroduction, benefits of all species, the predator hunting, balancing nature for the benefit of all species, the role of hound hunting, understanding a time-honored tradition and its contributions to wildlife management. And that is a biggie. We should really talk about that because that was a crushing blow to a lot of people and a lot of animals. I don't think people realize the devastation on the dogs. Equal Access to Justice Act, eco-litigation, and judicial interference, how the abuse of the system undermines real wildlife conservation. And if the Equal Access to Justice Act, the EAJA, is not a familiar term to you, I don't care who you are, it should be familiar to you because that is how environmental groups basically fundraise, sue and settle, and we're talking you know, if you live anywhere that's had a fire, so now we can include L.A., because of land management, EAJA is the rat in the wood pile on that one. Another link here, A Path Forward, Undoing the Damage of Ballot Box Biology. I look at it and I can't pronounce it. Ballot Box Biology, I really want you to talk about that too. And then Humans, a Part of the Natural Balance, Rethinking, Let Nature Take Care of Itself. Ugh. God, how many times have you heard that? So we'll, of course, have to do, you know, more programming with you in the future. But
there's a lot to unpack.
Because that was kind of a long list. But honestly, I kind of wanted to, because not everyone goes to the website. Sometimes people listen. Sometimes people just listen to the archive. Maybe you don't listen to the archive. We make a lot of effort with the People Radio website to give you enough so that if you just want to go find out about the issue and maybe you don't want to listen, there's enough on the page that you can get smarter on that. So,
yeah.
Talk about the dogs so we don't lose them in the mix. The hound hunting.
Yeah, hound hunting. It's so easy to. First of all, the anti-hunting industry, they'll go after, I call it the low-hanging fruit, they go after the segments of the hunting and outdoors community that's the smallest and easiest to divide up, you know, create a division from them and others. And so the use of hounds and the use of dogs across all forms of hunting has been part of the human tradition for thousands of years. We domesticated dogs primarily to have hunting partners, you know, thousands of years ago. That was the primary purpose. It wasn't so we could have a fluffy animal, you know, in our tent or teepee or you know, cave. It was so that we would have a partner in hunting. And so dogs across most breeds had some function for pursuit or retrieval of animals. And that is largely lost, except for within some communities of people that still cherish that practice. They develop and maintain breeds that are specifically just hardwired to pursue animals or to retrieve animals for us. And there's nothing that the anti-hunting industry would like to do more than eliminate that. And when I say eliminate, they would like to eliminate not just in the use of hounds to pursue and tree bears and mountain lions, but they want to eliminate it to the point where we couldn't even use dogs to retrieve waterfowl that we've shot out of the sky. And so it's a very serious threat. And I've never run hounds before. I haven't done it. I haven't pursued a lion or a bear, you know, following hounds through the woods. But I've seen enough of it to know it is incredibly physical, incredibly difficult. And the hounds community, the houndsman community has a tremendous affection and love for their dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And those two things are the things that the anti-hunters turn on their head. They say that it's cruel to the dogs, and they say that it's easy for the humans. Like, we just pull up in the truck and hop out, and lo and behold, our dogs are right there with a mountain lion in the tree, and we shoot it.
Yeah, right.
It's not remotely that easy. The dogs will pursue an animal over miles and miles of difficult terrain. And a lot of houndsmen that do practice this, they actually will tree and free the majority of the animals that they catch. The majority of the bears that are treed are then let go and freed. The majority of the mountain lions that are treed are let go and freed. And so they love the pursuit, and they love the adventure and the physicality of it. And then also learning about those animals that they're pursuing. They're not killing every one of them, not by a huge margin. And so it's important, I think, that we all, before we say, oh, that's bad, that we actually get to know what's happening.
Yeah.
Before we just condemn it. Like, we all need to be open to the idea that this is something new. Maybe it's cultural. Maybe it's heritage. It's a practice that we're not familiar with, and we need to be ready to support it until we have any other reason not to.
Well,
they're going after it.
They are. And the other part of the story that was really, has always been very interesting to me about that particular practice with houndsmen, besides the fact they love their dogs, the hounds, that's their job. That's what God made them to do. And so when you prevent that and expect them to just, well, now they're just going to hang out around the house, the dogs go
right
berserk. And I heard from many houndsmen that they had to put their dogs down because the dogs couldn't, they just couldn't
adapt to.
Yeah. That
right
was their thing.
Domestic.
Because I think, and I'm not an expert on this at all, but. And it's been a while, but didn't they say you can't have dogs out there in the woods, like running? That it's against the law now in California that if the dogs chase animals around, isn't there a big thing about that? Wasn't that part of it?
Well, there's wildlife harassment, and so if you have a dog that just randomly pursues a deer, that is considered wildlife harassment, and that's against the law. It's an infraction, but. Pursuit of lions and bears specifically is not legal because it's considered hunting with hounds.
Right.
The houndsmen in California still chase raccoons, and I don't know if they can chase foxes or not. So there are still a community of houndsmen in California that do breed and keep, you know, hounds for the purpose of going after animals. But the two, you know, bobcats, so the three bobcats, mountain lions, and bears were the three larger species that were most commonly pursued. And those are illegal now. We do have, and if you got to our action center, you know, I'm glad you brought this up because these laws were passed either through ballot box biology or through the legislature.
So
you know,
tell
they were
people
passed by the commission.
Yeah, tell people about the ballot box biology because that strikes home with me. But I deal in that for work.
So, yeah, in most states you have a commission and a department. The commission is a group of, you know, say 5 to 9 people that have a charter to curate the laws related to wildlife and hunting and whatnot. Then you have the department. They go out and enforce the laws. They administer the hunting programs. They do the science and the research. That's where most regulations should come from. Those are the experts in the field. They've got the best knowledge and they've got the charter to do this work. when the ballot, when some people go to the legislature, say, hey, legislature, I don't like what's going on over there in the commission, so I'm going to ask you, I'm going to lobby you to make a law. Even though you're not as informed and you're not as close to the issue, I'm going to lobby you to make a law. And I think that's bad. Worse yet is when the legislature won't even pick it up. And you take this very emotional issue sometimes and go to the ballot box. You just put it on the ballot as an initiative, and you ask people that are completely unremoved from the participation, from the issues, from the science, and you can paint a very emotional picture of something and completely skew the public perception, you know, for a period of a month to get people to write, you know, fill in a bubble on their ballot about something that they generally don't think about 364 days a year. And so that's where you get really bad outcomes for wildlife. You get bad outcomes for hunting opportunity, bad outcomes for conservation. And we've had that a lot here in California, primarily with the mountain lion hunting ban that took place in 1990. So that's, we were in Colorado last year a bunch trying to protect mountain lion hunting successfully, and we successfully did. From a ballot box initiative. And there were people in the streets that literally would say, why am I even voting on this? You know, like, why am I being asked to choose this? Don't we have a department that regulates this already?
Yeah, isn't there actual science?
Yeah, and we said, bingo, that's exactly it. Why are you voting on this? You do have a department that decides this with science. And so they got it. They realized that they were effectively in Colorado. That proposition was trying to manipulate their knowledge, manipulate their emotions to have them vote for something that couldn't otherwise be put in place through the department, the commission, or even the legislature. So, you know, we don't do ballot initiatives on, you know, speed limits and air traffic control.
No.
Or brain surgery. So we shouldn't be doing ballot initiatives.
It's really crazy because even back when they listed wolves in California in 2015, at that meeting, and I said this the other night, that the Fish and Game Commission, the Fish and Game Department, so the department of that said, we don't think you should list them. Their recommendation was not to list them. But
wow.
I know. I thought that was pretty weighty. Actually, Chuck Bonham, not necessarily part of the fan club here, but he said, I think it's a bad idea. But then you had like the lady I described with the wolf hat. I should post a picture of that on the website. It's just crazy. She got up there and said, you know, she wanted, please, you have to list them. You have to endanger them. You know, I want my 3-year-old to meet one in the backyard one day. Mm. Have the joy of meeting one in the backyard. I thought, wow. Yeah.
It's going to be a short meeting.
Child Protective Services all the way. So just, you have people who don't have any knowledge. But then the other part we're leaving out is the science that's just flat cooked. I mean, they just lie about it. And as we have recently learned, 10 years into the listing of wolves in the state of California, they have not decided how many wolves is enough wolves.
Yeah, that's the part that gets me, is they don't have a plan for when enough is enough.
They don't have an end point. So
and that brings up a good point. What, maybe you can help me with
how
this.
How much is enough?
how fast do they populate? I mean, if they drop 2 or 3 pairs in an area, how fast does that population grow?
I think in Idaho, using that as one benchmark, in Idaho, they went from 100 to about 350 in 2 to 3 years, and then they got over 600 in, I think, another 2 years.
Oh,
so they can get to a point where the recolonization process starts very slow, and then it can hit an exponential growth curve, and then that curve only flattens out when they start hitting saturation for whatever habitat that they're in.
Right. As long as there's food on the ground, they're going to keep growing.
Which might have been why it took us 100 years to eradicate them.
Yeah, space to expand into and food on the ground. And if the food includes, you know, human-provided food like livestock, California is a big state. And there's a lot of livestock and a lot of, you know, goats and sheep and dairy cattle and calves. And so like, we have, that's where I stood in front of the commission in December and said wolf management plan, I think, for the first time in the commission space in the last few years. Like, we have a problem. Like, we really do. I think we really have an ecosystem problem, and it's coming.
Yeah.
We didn't get ahead of the forest fire and the wildland fire problem. People knew that was coming. It was called. It was predicted. And it happened. And now people think, oh, yeah, forestry management is good. We need that. And so there's support for that now that we've had the crisis.
Right.
We have an ecosystem crisis coming, and it is a complete lack of management across multiple apex predators, which is only going to be exacerbated by wolves recolonizing California.
Yeah. Yeah.
If only we could get tigers, we could have the Wizard of Oz, right? Lions,
well, another thing you hear is these ranchers, if they do have a loss, they get compensated for that. You know, the fishing game will come out and you know, write them a check, you know. So how's that working out?
On that note, we do have to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with the joy of how that works.
Okay.
Because that is something the public should know. And it does come from your tax dollars, and it isn't what you think. So we will be right back. And as it would be, I have chosen the perfect song.
You're kidding.
No.
You?
No, to lead into that particular topic. So you can find us at WePeopleRadio.us.
Compliance. We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore. No more defiance. Need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore. No more self-reliance. Oh, I'm just trying to make believe that everything you're telling me is true. Come on, baby, want to do?
We go. Got the soundtrack for the compensation plan right there.
There you are.
So Mike, tell us. You're a cattle rancher, and you've got cattle, and, you know, they decide to overpopulate wolves in your area, and then it's all going to work out for you, though.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a cattle rancher, the first thing I want to do is raise these animals so they can be fed to wildlife. Coming onto my property. Like, that's all I really care about. No, I want to flip the script though a little bit. I want to ask another question. So folks that live in you know, basic suburban neighborhoods, you know, 5,000 square foot house, 2-car garage, you know, lawn in the front. Let's remove all the front doors.
Yeah.
And let's remove all the back doors and just say, look, it doesn't really matter that people are going to come into your house and steal things, because no matter how traumatizing that is and how invaded you feel, we're going to pay you back for whatever they steal.
Right. You can call the police.
And
right.
Those people need those things. Those predators, those human predators, they need those things. And so, because they can't provide for themselves on the landscape. And so we're just going to do this thing where you can't protect any of your stuff. And you can't protect any of your boundaries. But don't worry, we'll reimburse you and pat you on the back and tell you that you're made whole. Because that's what's happening in all the rural counties where you have, well, wolves, but you also have, you don't get reimbursement if you have a mountain lion or a bear take one of your animals or your pet or your dog. So this issue is happening not just with wolves, but throughout the state and every rural and any community with the urban, with any kind of wildland interface, that you're being told that the critters have more rights than you do. and I think that's just massively flawed.
Yeah. Yeah, it is massively flawed. And then the other part of it that is, which is why, you know, we've given people now over an hour to absorb the idea that that wolves as an apex predator kill for sport. So mm-hmm. they leave these animals maimed. They're not necessarily dead. So
right.
that doesn't count as a, quote, wolf kill. That's right. just an animal that's now got to be put down.
But do you actually get reimbursed? I mean, is that...
Maybe.
Yeah. How difficult is that?
There's a framework. There's a decision-making framework, you know, that they have to go through. Because it's the government, you know, there's going to be a framework, and they have to say, was this a wolf kill? And so they have to determine, you know, there's DNA swabbing, genetic testing, there's paw prints, and they're looking for a number of different data points that they can say it was a wolf kill definitively, it might have been, it probably was, or we're not sure. And there's a lot of factors that go into, even if we say that the department has the best of intentions and there's unlimited funds to do this, there's still scientific factors that throw curveballs that make it so it's hard to determine sometimes. But there's not unlimited funds, and there's limited resources from a headcount perspective. There's limited resources from a disbursement perspective. And so the answer, when you get down to the number of depredations of livestock being killed or maimed or going to die soon because of wolves in the pasture, not everybody's going to get paid. I think that's just a fact.
Absolutely not. And for the cattle that are just hazed, there was a terrific video, and I'm just sorry it's no longer on the Oregon State University website, where a guy did an experiment. You know, collared a bunch of cattle, a professor collared a bunch of cattle, and they had some wolves that were already collared, and they followed them. You know, how did they interact? And at one point, I'll never forget it, because it was a topographical map that the dots were on, little blue dots were the cows. And those cows were moving at 7 miles an hour up a grade to try to escape the wolves. They were the cattle all, yeah, they're hanging out, you know, out on the open plain. You know, see the blue dots everywhere.
And then all of a sudden,
like, bloop, 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 they get closer and closer and closer and then take off running.
They're being pushed.
Correct. And that has an effect on the livestock producer as well. I mean, if you look at this just from a...
Oh, yeah, they can't be gaining weight and getting fat when they're running all night long. Yeah.
So you're busy destroying that.
Right.
There just is a ton of cost in there, and as a taxpayer, I resent that money that is confiscated from me to pay for things is going into stuff like this without... I don't think most people would be on board with this if they actually knew the entire picture.
And it's going to raise the cost of your beef. It's
Absolutely.
Going to raise the cost of food. It's going to raise the cost of food. And the irony, of course, is so much of what we do in the U.S. is we say, well, we can import it from somewhere else. So we start buying, you know, cheaper beef that's imported from South America. Guess what they did to the wolves in South America? They're all dead. so it's like, okay, well, we'll just import beef from
Brilliant.
Places that haven't reintroduced the apex predators, because they're smart. They're like, well, we wouldn't do that. That would be dumb.
Yeah, right. And they have no controls over how their animals are raised or treated or
right.
dealt with. Or so, who,
right.
I mean,
yeah.
Look what happened with dog food out of China. You know, they yeah. couldn't even make dog food, for God's sake. So what the heck would we want to buy beef from any of these people? But
you know, there's a move to do, you know, this regenerative agriculture thing. I'm dabbling with the idea. Do I want to get into ranching? And I know there's lots of people that say you're crazy to think about that, but there's this thing about regenerative agriculture where they talk about, you know, increasing the number of animals per acre, but you move them every day, you're out there, you know, you're stewarding them on the pasture, on, you know, really wild landscapes, you move them every day, and actually as they leave the ecosystem behind them better than it was. And that's a great idea, But then you throw in something like, oh, by the way, you need to do this in an area with these apex predators, and you can't do anything about those apex predators.
Yeah, right.
In fact, you should go back to fences and flattery and fox lights and disco balls to keep the apex predators away. Like, which do we want? Do we want to use livestock to do benefit, you know, do ecosystem services on the landscape? Or do you want to put them all in pens to keep them protected with high fences to protect them from apex predators?
Well, we tried that with chickens, and now you got to buy free-range eggs. So, you know, that they aren't going to allow
that. That's the one that'll pull Bill out of a coma.
Yeah.
Free-range chickens. Bill's back.
Yeah. No, I work very hard to find eggs that aren't free-range eggs.
He goes crazy.
It just drives me nuts. It's a chicken.
You're the one that wants those?
Bill's like, I hate that free-range egg thing. That's just so stupid.
Yep.
Yeah. And then I start ranting about flattery. You should go to the store with us.
Because I'll tell you what, I've searched long and hard for whale oil, and I can't find it.
Hey, and whale oil and tiger meat.
Yeah.
We've looked everywhere, but at Costco, you know, the only endangered species they ever carry is coho salmon.
Yeah.
Yep.
Crazy.
Yeah.
This is crazy, you know. None of the other endangered species are there. good.
So, but it's, you know, this payback thing, like, there's a matrix of rules and expectations that just doesn't work. Like, it doesn't pencil. And people, I think when we get to like go back to like the advocacy thing, so what do we need to do? Like, we need to talk to the people. We can't talk to the ideologically captured people that are just like the woman that wore the wolf hat in that meeting. Like, we just need to talk to the people that I'm saying, you're going to have your doors and windows removed from your house. You need to let people come and steal stuff from you. We need to talk to those folks that think that's crazy, because it is. Well, that's what's being asked of ranchers. That's what's being asked of livestock owners. And that's what's being asked of, you know, people that care for wildlife and, you know, prey species on the landscape. We need to talk to them about stories that are relatable so they can see, wow, this is really a difficult matrix of requirements. What are some simple solutions that we could do that actually create results? Because I think the solutions are simple. And you don't even have to say you want to exterminate wolves. Like, we just need to be able to put up
boundaries like we had before we let them run the place.
And
the thing is, let's say for all those people that, you know, they have deer that come in their backyard or wherever, you know, or they like seeing them out in the, not in the road, obviously, because that's a problem. But just, they like wildlife. Maybe they don't hunt. They don't do any of those things. Maybe they don't even go in the woods, but they like the idea that there's wildlife out there. Hot tip, they're wiping them out too.
Yeah.
Like, they're wiping all of it out.
Yep.
And the more of them there are, the fewer of all those other things there will be. And that doesn't make sense.
Well, I think what really kind of riles people is the fact that when they put these management plans together, they don't take into consideration, they say they do, but they don't take into consideration the impact of dropping, what was it, 12 wolves they just dropped in Plumas County?
Well, they claim that they just captured them, put collars on them, and then let them go again.
They were already there. Yeah.
Those are existing packs, I think.
But people saw that when, you know.
There's an article I just ran across today on MSN it's on the internet. It's called Blue State Ranchers Thrown to the Wolves Seek President Trump's Rescue. It tries to tell both sides of the story on this. I think they do a fairly decent job on it, but they talk about these issues of ranchers being victimized. I can't believe that it's allowed to continue when they have such overwhelming evidence that their animals are getting slaughtered. And it's they kind of go into some detail about, you know, how these animals are dying, and it's not pretty. I think people need to read the article and get a feel for what's actually happening.
The pictures of what they do to the cattle that they don't kill
and the calves, you know, the small calves, I mean, they don't they can't defend themselves. I mean, a cow can't defend itself against a wolf, let alone a calf. And they have a hard time accounting when they send these cattle up into the mountain ranges to birth, and they don't come back with all the calves they thought they were going to have. Well,
surprise.
Yeah, surprise.
Well, you know, that kind of reminds me, though, that we kind of skipped over the part about with the collaring, besides the fact that you have to keep catching them and putting new batteries in, and they become habituated to human contact, which is obviously not what we want. The other piece of that is the myth way back when was, we're going to collar these animals, and we're going to let you know when they are near your cattle. And that is absolutely a lie. Because they find out days and weeks later, that is never real-time information. So in case somebody out there is thinking, well, they collar them and tell them when they're nearby, that doesn't happen.
That doesn't happen.
Because they're afraid that they'll be killed, and they don't want that information public, so they don't want people out there looking at them. There's that, too. You know, you have the people who are kind of like the wolf groupies.
Yep.
Yeah.
You mentioned Equal Access to Justice Act. Remember that, so in 2022... United States Fish and Wildlife Services, under Biden, declared that wolves were no longer, they didn't warrant listing under the Endangered Species Act in North America. The Fish and Wildlife Services delisted wolves nationwide, all 48 lower 48 states. And it was a judge, because there was a lawsuit filed by the protectionist preservationist orgs. There was a judge in the Ninth District in California that overturned that delisting. So the science has been proven multiple times that wolves warrant delisting. But because you can sue on behalf of the ESA or on behalf of, you know, a citizen, you can sue and find a judge that will flip this thing. And then those organizations get paid with taxpayer dollars for bringing the lawsuit because of the EAJA. They're listed again. And so, like, this is not, it's not like you're not an outlier to say that wolves should be delisted. That's been determined at a scientific level multiple times. So there's multiple reforms there. There's ESA reform that needs to happen. There's the Equal Access to Justice Act reform that needs to happen. And hopefully these reforms can happen here soon with the administration and Congress that we've got. But we've got to be vocal about that and support those things.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean we're going to wipe everything out. It just means we're going to kind of recalibrate. It's very much like California, for anybody who follows crime. We finally got the citizens of California to pass Prop 36. And and the tagline on that was, make crime crime again. You know?
Right.
Like, it's crazy to think that you need to go back to allowing law enforcement to put criminals in jail for committing crimes. But we had to do that because we had gone so far afield with the whole feel-good movement. Like, oh, if we just the idea originally was, if we stopped putting all these people in jail, there would be less crime. And it's like, no, there would just be less record of it.
Well, the ballot initiative that brought it to that point. The ballot initiatives that brought us to that point were completely misrepresented.
Yeah.
Again, a ballot initiative, you can create three bullet points and a slogan, and they can be complete lies.
I think
it was passed as Save Our Schools.
No, Save Schools and Streets Act.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Who doesn't want Save Schools and Streets?
Like, oh, who's going to vote against that?
Exactly.
Nobody read it, and so there's no requirement for them to be appropriately represented in the media or in the literature that advocates for these things. And so same thing with wildlife management. Like, we have undone wildlife management at so many levels in California. One of our visions at Howl is we want to come back with our own version of Prop 36 that takes apart all these rules and regulations and laws that have been constructed outside of the department and the commission, and push all of those things back to the department and the commission to decide. That's where those decisions to be made. Make wildlife management great again.
Yeah.
You
heard it here first. Yay.
You heard it here first.
Oh, my God. We have to take a really quick break again. We're going to come back with Mike Costello. He is with Howl for Wildlife. Their website is Howl, H-O-W-L, forwildlife.org. And, yeah, there's just so much on this. And as a taxpayer, I don't care where you live, you should care about it, because this is part of why your wallet is crying every night when you go to bed and you hear it in there whimpering in your...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Followed by a growl in the dark.
It's not good. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities, Mother Nature's recipe. Bring the bare necessities of life. Wherever I wander, wherever I roam.
If my party's all right, I want. Now don't talk to me about the polar bear. Don't talk to me about the ozone layer. Ain't so much of anything these days, even the air. You're running out of rhinos, what do I care? Let's hear it for the dolphin. Let's hear it for the trees. Ain't running out of nothing in my ideas. It's casual entertainment, we aim to be. And my party is alright, uh-huh. Do what you please.
Ah, yes. The Endangered Species Act reform soundtrack was written years ago by a song called My Parties by Dire Straits. I love that song. It makes me laugh every time. Okay, so back to Equal Access to Justice Act and all the craziness. How about that?
Yeah. We need reform on that, the Endangered Species Act, the Antiquities Act, and I think there's going to be an opportunity to support those things. The whole thing about contact your electeds, it's hard. People don't do it. It's hard to know when something's, like, is it being decided today? Is it next week when I reach out? But these are some big issues that we can participate in. And if we get these reforms to what were probably good ideas, but they've been executed badly, and now we can fix them, it'll be good for landscapes, wildlife, it'll be good for us culturally, socially. You know, it'll just be financially. It'll be good for everybody. So they're important issues to track, I think.
Yeah, it really is. And the amount of money that is going to this sort of thing. I mean, imagine the California Department of Fish and Game Wildlife. That department has had a wolf management plan on the ground for 10 years this year. That was listed November 12th of 2015. And after 10 years, they don't know how many wolves is enough on the landscape in this state. How do you even explain that?
They don't. And so in that regard, it's time for us to start talking to the commission, and the Fish and Game Commission is really easy to talk to through email or even jumping on their meetings in Zoom and talking during public comment. Like we as a community need to start talking to the commission about the fact that this management plan hasn't been looked at significantly in 10 years, and we have an issue that's developing, and it's time to revisit the management plan, make it practical and pragmatic, and fix some things.
Well, in the original agreement or in the original plan, was there a number in that plan about how many would be right before they started culling the herd?
So lethal removal is a management tool that's considered in phase three. And that's when there's eight or more breeding pairs, and we're at five or six breeding pairs now, but we're at like 10 packs. And so I think once you get a pack in place, which is a male and a female, once they show that that's a breeding pair, so maybe a year later, we're on the cusp of having 10 packs or 10 breeding pairs, and that it's within reach. And so it's time to start moving through these phases and looking at, and even now, 10 years later, maybe the phases weren't set up right. Maybe the impacts relative to what phase that they're in weren't estimated very well because they were looking in a crystal ball that was a little foggy 10 years
right.
ago. Well, we have documentary now. We have reality now. And so they can go back to this and make some very pragmatic adjustments to it and bring lethal removal in because they don't want cattle being killed on somebody's ranch in Modoc County every other week. So lethal removal is a tool that's considered in a range of about 100 to 150 wolves on the landscape, and that's roughly where we are, we will be soon. The holding capacity that's estimated for all of Northern California, they look at it two different ways, one based on prey species and one based on geography, and that number is roughly 350. Like the center of those two estimates is about 350 animals. But that was based on the prey base 10 years ago. We don't have the same prey base as we did then.
They think that so, you need 350 wolves in north. Just to let's not gloss that over. What's the geography?
Yeah. No, that's maximum. That's like the idea. Like the holding capacity, not where we would delist, but steady state, long term holding capacity for the habitat that's available to them would be about 350 wolves.
And that's just California.
Northern California, like north of Interstate 80.
I think
that's where you are, you know. But I see us eclipsing without practical management tools in place, and like it or not, the friction that a wolf pack will respond to is being shot at is lethal removal is seeing the dog next to them get killed. You know, they learn from loud noises and scary events. And fox lights and disco balls are not loud enough.
We all know
enough.
That the F word, fladry, yeah. is stupid.
Right. Doesn't do it.
Yeah.
Doesn't do it. So if we're going to have 350 wild wolves living off of the natural ecosystem, not subsidized by human foods that we provide them, there need to be some practical changes that take place. And they need to happen soon. Otherwise, every generation of new wolves that are born on this landscape are going to be developing bad habits, bad dependencies mm-hmm. on livestock.
Right.
Yeah, why not? Honestly, that's just silly. It's silly to think that you would travel hundreds of miles in the wilderness looking for, you know, bunnies and foxes and whatever to chase
right.
around when you could just scurry on down to the local rancher's backyard, right, or acreage, and mm-hmm. eat up some yummy cows.
Well, cows, sheep, mm-hmm. goats. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there.
We interviewed the Sitaway Sheep Company 10 years ago, and a couple of wolves ran 176 sheep off a cliff. Now, granted, sheep are not the brightest
bull. Looking for a way to die.
Yeah, they spend their whole life finding a way to die. As we learned from the veterinarian who told us to just get a new one. We're never coming out to look at your sheep. I was like, what? But it's Eunice. We love Eunice. He's like, yeah, get a new one.
That's funny.
So, kind of sad. But no, they're not bright. However, that's the kind of damage that is
right.
done. And that wasn't to eat them.
That was just the fun of the chase.
God, if you learn nothing else, that was sport. That
right.
was sport.
And it seems like, oh, no, they wouldn't do that. But I have three dogs. Like, I have one dog that loves to chase lizards. He chases lizards. He gets them in his mouth. He kills them. And then he, like, licks them. And he's like, oh, what'd you do? Why'd you die? Come back. Like, why aren't you moving anymore? You were fun.
You wrecked the game.
And then that lizard stops moving. He goes on and finds another one.
Yeah.
Like this is not about sustenance and protein in his belly. It is absolute sport for him to do that. And there's no reason why we should expect anything different from a group of four or five apex predators on the landscape.
But let's not put too fine a point on it, right? We are apex predators. And lest we forget, we have the Investigation Discovery Channel along with many others, and everything on there is about apex predator, human apex predators who like to kill for sport. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So
right.
The idea that a wild animal wouldn't kill for sport, really? Like,
right.
Yeah, they totally would. I just with the Fish and Game Commission meetings in different states and stuff, do you guys link that on your website and make that available to people who sign up for your newsletter? Like, hey, there's a meeting you can plug in on this day. Do you sort of
if there's a specific issue, so our action center, if you go to our take action on our website, howforwildlife.org, take action, you'll see right now there's probably 9 different tiles there of issues in play. And so we put issues there, whether it's legislative or in a commission setting, where people can send a message that we've researched, and we've got some value statements that make sense, we believe, that they can send to a commission or a legislative body when an issue's up in play. We don't host information from every commission or every legislature unless it's right now. Like, now is the time to take action on this. And so we kind of curate based on stakeholder feedback, local coalitions that reach out and say, hey, can you help us with this? We'd like to do a lot of research and know that we're not going to step into something without context and mess things up for the locals if we don't understand what's going on.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So we host things there depending on where the fire is. First, you could say, where's the fire? Where's the issue? We do research. We put together value statements. And then the nice thing is now is the anti-hunting industry, they fundraise from folks in Florida to do things against Montana. They fundraise from people in New Jersey to do things against Californians. Our action center is set up so no matter what species you're interested in, say you're a duck hunter, but you want to support, mountain lion hunting in Colorado, so you can cross species, cross state lines, cross methods of take, and support other hunters, other people that are part of the natural world and their issues just by taking action. So I think you mentioned some of the other organizations in the conservation space. Most of them are species specific. You have Rocky Mountain Elk. They do great things for elk habitat. Mule Deer Foundation. They do great things for mule deer habitat. We work on advocacy issues regardless of species, regardless of method of take. Whether you're a bow hunter or a trapper or a houndsman, we're going to support you. And so that's where we're not just siloed. We can start coming together as communities. And with this wolf issue, we're finding we need to bridge into and talk to the ranchers.
Yep.
Because we have very similar goals, very similar concerns. As a hunter, I want the wildlife to be okay. I want lots of deer and elk and antelope out in the landscape along with predators. But this wolf issue is not helping those deer and elk and antelope. Ranchers have the same concerns about the way the wolves are recolonizing California and what few tools they have. And so that's why we're really starting to find this commonality on some of these issues. Ranchers care about the land. We care about the land. And so that's how our action center works, is it's based on where's the issue today and how do we get stakeholders across different communities to participate and support each other.
Yeah, because you guys call it the Action Den. So I'm putting that on the front page right next to your bio. So that's like the top thing on the page. And and so people will see that, because that, honestly, you can be, you can be all informed and everything, but if you actually never lift a finger and do anything, you don't move the needle on this kind of stuff.
Right.
It just continues to go downhill.
It's hard to know where an issue is. Like, is this issue in the commission? Is this issue in a Senate committee? Is it in an assembly committee? If I contact my elected, do they even know about it?
Right. And there's nothing worse than having your activists get kicked in the teeth all the time. They mm-hmm. make calls and it doesn't mean anything, or the people go, what are you talking about? They stop calling. So I think it's awesome that you guys give them those tools, because without that, they're ineffective.
Yeah.
And people don't do that twice. If they're going to take the time to make the call and then they get, you know, kind of shut down. Besides that, don't call people that are on your team. So it's sort of nice to know, you know, where are your electeds on these things before you blow their phones up.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah. And if you're a state senator who's not in favor of delisting wolves, you should be calling them a lot. A lot.
Yeah.
You're
federal
senator. Sorry.
That's not on there yet, but it's going to be.
It is.
We need that.
We need
our state senators to support Californians. Because wolves are going to be they'll be in 40 counties by, you know, 5 years from now.
They will. They're absolutely. Yeah, they're absolutely going to do that. We are going to goof off with Mike again on another day. Talk about stuff like this. Howlforwildlife.org. You got to go there.
Yeah.
So you can find the archive of the show and send it to your friends and family at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
And thanks Mike. Yeah, thanks for coming on. Great show.
Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.